Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Steinberg, editor-in-chief at San Francisco Magazine and your moderator for today's program. And now I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Kurt Anderson, author of the new book, True Believers. Let's give Mr. Anderson a round of applause. Mr. Anderson has had an illustrious career as a New York Times best-selling author and cultural critic. He is the co-founder and host of PRI's Studio 360, a Peabody Award-winning show, the editor and co-founder of the satirical monthly magazine Spy, and the editor-in-chief of my previous employer, New York Magazine. In addition to his latest book, True Believers, Mr. Anderson is also the author of the critically acclaimed Heyday and Turn of the Century. Welcome.
Thanks. Happy to be here. Happy to be here in under 70 degree weather that I haven't experienced.
What a nice change for you. So you were on Charlie Rose just last night in New York.
Yes, I was. With the Russian ambassador to the UN.
With the Russian ambassador to the UN. And now you are here on Market Street with me.
Yes.
That must be a harsh come down for
you. No. No makeup.
What we really want to know, though, more than anything, is what is Charlie Rose really like?
He's very nice to me. So he's great. He is pretty much what you get.
But I hear he's a party animal. He's a monster on the dance floor.
Well,
these things.
You know, he does. He lives life to the fullest.
Well, I'm asking this in particular because, and I want to start by disarming Kurt in order to warm him up. That he was the subject of a great book party in New York that was featured in the New York Times. Of course, Charlie Rose was there, as was Graydon Carter, Martha Stewart, Harvey Weinstein, Barry Dillon, Diane von Furstenberg, Raymond Kelly, the chief of police of New York, Arianna Huffington, and on and on and on. So I just want you all to know that you're in the presence of true New York big shot.
Friend of true New York big shots.
True New York big shots. All of which is a warm-up to... introduce your book, which is written by another true New York big shot, a woman named Karen Hollander, who is an esteemed lawyer. It was a Justice Department official who was a Supreme Court law clerk, and who, as the story goes, has a great big secret that she's about to reveal. One of the main temptations we all have with novelists is to ask, how does your life overlap with that of your central characters?
Yeah.
So go ahead and tell us in what ways you do and don't.
There are many more ways in which they don't overlap. She's a woman. I'm not. She's about 6 years, 5 or 6 years older than I am. We both of us grew up in the Midwest. She in North Shore, Chicago. Me in Omaha, Nebraska. I was alive during the 1960s. What else? She went to Radcliffe. I went to Harvard. She has type 1 diabetes. I have type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. That's about it.
Well, the diabetes notion is not just some circumstantial thing. It actually plays a pretty major role in her awakening, in some ways. Can you?
Yeah. Well, she was diagnosed with what was then called juvenile diabetes when she was 17 years old, just turning 18. When 20 years before I was, and it was much more difficult to manage and deal with back then. But it also, I had never seen it dealt with, the internal experience of dealing with it and having hypoglycemic episodes and all the rest, in fiction. And prose fiction seemed like an ideal way to use this material that I have and know well, because it's because in a novel, it's all internal, right? And especially in a first-person novel. So to the degree that she gets this in 1967, she's just turning 18, it definitely adds to her sense of seize the day, of to hell with it all. I'm gonna head for the deep end and go off. You know, as a way to make her adolescence at this time of extraordinary change and volatility in the culture be more extreme in her particular case. So yeah, it's not a huge thing, but it is, as you say, it's not just a passing character,
right?
Characteristic.
It's a relatively small thing, but now let me ask about a big thing. Why did you choose a female narrator of several years older than you, who comes from a similar place that you do, a Midwestern family, who shares a obsession with James Bond, I think has been...
Oh, actually, another thing. She has a Danish father. I have a Danish great-grandfather. I mean, her father emigrated from Denmark. Well, I'll take those one at a time. A woman, because the novel is set... She's writing this memoir of her life in the present day, actually the near future, but basically the present day. So it flips back and forth, essentially, chapter by chapter from now and then the 1960s and now and the 1960s. And one reason I chose it, I made her a woman, was it seems to me that life, to the degree it's a chronicle of these 45 years, these 50 years, that women's lives have changed more dramatically and interestingly than men's. So that seemed like a reason to make her a woman. The fact that there is a romantic triangle or two involved in the story, it made it more interesting to me to have it have the female character in those triangles be the one telling the story. I found that with my previous novels, I really liked writing women characters, and I sort of fell in love with them. And those were third person novels, so I decided, okay, I'm going to write a novel in the first person. Who do I want to spend 3 years with? And I decided to make her a woman for that reason as well. Also, in the particular case of this story, because in 1967 and 1968, when she gets involved in, she and her friends become anti-war radicals, she couldn't be drafted, and her two male best friends, three male best friends as it becomes, were all vulnerable to the draft, she felt... I thought that was interesting in terms of the narrative as well, of making her feel like she doesn't have skin in the game, like she's a kind of a bystander, that the fact that she was a girl and didn't face the draft was a way that this particular character would be motivated to prove her radical bona fides.
Mm-hmm. It's been noticed by some astute readers that that she may be a stand-in for a very well-known political figure, a woman who was born right around the same time, Hillary Clinton. Did that enter your mind as you were writing it?
It didn't, oddly. Even though I have an unnamed Hillary Clinton appear as a 16... She appears in a cameo as a 16-year-old because she grew up not far away on the North Shore of Chicago from where my character Karen lived as a child. But no, I never thought of it as... I did not think of her as Hillary-esque, oddly, until I was done and people would say, oh, what's this about and what's the idea? And I would give the basic, short-form synopsis, and people would say, oh, like Bernadine Dorn, you mean? She's like that? I said, no. Completely unlike Bernadine Dorn or any of those people. I said... She's more like Hillary Clinton if Hillary had never married Bill and had just become a famous lawyer. And so it was only in the aftermath that I thought of her as at all Hillary-esque. I thought of movie stars who could play my character, but I didn't think of Hillary Clinton as a...
And who's your first choice?
Well, of course, Meryl Streep and her daughter as the young her, you know.
Right.
But I you know, that, I'm not exclusively married to that idea. Hollywood has other ideas.
Right. Kate Winslet, yeah. If she's available. The reason that it's also sort of an obvious question to ask about Hillary is that this is such a politically minded book. It's not just a potboiler. It's not just a sort of a drawn-out mystery story. It is a commentary about the state of affairs in the late 60s and the comparative madness that has sort of overtaken America now. What was in your mind when you set out to write about these periods of times, the now compared to 1968? Why was it important to write about it in this year?
Well, it was going to be a story. It was really, I didn't have this half set now, half set then idea. That came as I went along. But it then, because I was doing that and because I was having this person at age, you know, in her early 60s, reflect on this time and the craziness that she got involved in and their mindset of the time. Inevitably, in the form of this book that's supposed to be her nonfiction memoir, she reflects on what got started in the 60s, how, you know, the 60s, today, compare, contrast, discuss. So she does a little bit of that, yes. So I didn't set out to do that, but then once I was setting in both times, and once I decided that she would be closer to her 17-year-old granddaughter than she is her own daughter, who's the girl's mother, I thought, oh, well, it'd be interesting to have this 17-year-old be some kind of protester, activist-type person, and that their conversations are about their particular characters and everything, but, yeah, they became a means to talk about this girl and her friends have a kind of, you can't call it nostalgia because they weren't alive, but a kind of yearning for the late 60s that they missed. And I, by just being a little younger than Karen Hollander and her friends, got to college in 1972 and felt like I'd missed it. You know, so I get that feeling at age 18. That sense that you know, whatever, the once every half century or once every century episode that the late 60s represented in terms of change and flux and strangeness, whether that goes along with the sense today that meaningful change can't happen, that our politics are dysfunctional. It was interesting to think about the two times in comparison, given that my character is very much, you know, she was, as you say, she was on the short list of the Supreme Court, and she's been a public figure. She thinks about where we are today, and inevitably she thinks about where we've come. And I, entirely apart from what my characters thought, have out of spending 3 years thinking about the 1960s versus today, have developed some ideas about what the 60s wrought.
You've written about that. You actually wrote about that in the New York Times recently, yeah. About how the sort of plague of individualism and selfishness that was started in the late 60s has its seeds, it has come of age now, and in a lot of the sort of cultural and political crises that we see today.
Well, yeah, and the 60s essentially, I mean, to put that in the brief algorithm form, the 60s minus communitarianism equals today. I mean, you know, people can dress as they want and speak as they want and get high if they want and watch porn 24 hours a day if they want, and all that do your own thing stuff that really began in the 1960s. And I believe that there's also one of the do your own thing as a capitalist and an investor, of which we haven't seen the likes in a century, that is now the paradigm today, also has some roots in that time. as well. So, you know, in this book, in this novel, I was trying to give, among other things, a picture of the 60s that doesn't necessarily conform to the, you know, iconic version of the 60s as it exists on the shelf, as it exists in literature that's been created about it, or movies. And this notion, which, as I say, is sort of a collateral idea that came out of the novel, is one that occurred to me as well.
It's often a very unromantic vision of the version of the 60s, in that I think you're very clear about how questions of sanity come up quite a bit. That these characters are sort of gripped with a mania that they can't control and that they don't really can. And I think that it seems to me that you can draw a similar parallel towards the granddaughter character, Waverly is her name, who is an occupier. She's been sort of captured by the romance of the Occupy movement. So,
although now, for the record, I invented her and her fellow protesters and all that before there was an Occupy movement.
So the WTO, she's a sort of WTO archetype too.
Exactly.
Speaking of Occupy, then, what do you make of its sort of its calming? It seems like you could have predicted it.
Before. Well, you know, we'll see. We'll see if maybe it was just, you know, the third and fourth quarter of 2011, and that'll be that. I personally think that some of the tectonic stresses in our political economy are such that, you know, whether or not Occupy is the name of the protests that develop next year or 3 years from now or whatever, I don't think they've shaken out. And of course, what's different is there, you know, in the late 60s, 18-year-old boys could get drafted and sent to fight a big war in which 60,000 instead of 6,000 people died ultimately. Also, in the late 60s, you had this protest movement in which a minority of that generation participated, but still a significant numbers. But it was part of this huge countercultural wave. So that even people who didn't go march in the Pentagon in 1967 or 1969 felt as though they were fellow travelers because they were, you know, listening to rock and roll. And Occupy does not have that cultural wave yet, if ever, or you know, to attach itself to. And, you know, I mean, in 1967, 1968, 1969, 1970, it was end the war, stop the draft, end the war, stop the draft. Very specific wishes and demands.
What are the demands of Occupy?
Well, yeah, exactly. Really make everything fairer. Mm-hmm. Yes, but, you know, I mean, so it's different. It's a little... You know, I don't want to pass harsh judgments on Occupy yet, but it's a little lame that it seems for the moment, as of, you know, July 25th, 2012, to have fizzled away.
It seems as if, I mean, 6 months ago people were predicting that the Democratic National Convention this summer would be like Chicago's Democratic National Convention in 1968, and it would galvanize a movement and it would become an iconic movement, an iconic moment in our political sort of evolution. Doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
Well, there'll be
right?
a bunch of people in North Carolina and certainly in Tampa protesting. In terms of the Democratic Convention, in 1968 you had, you know, a Democratic administration escalating a war in which hundreds of people were dying every week. And now you have a Democratic administration that has, you know, winding down wars and foreign entanglement. So, but this larger question of kind of hyper market mania and inequality of the kind we haven't seen in 80, 90 years and all the rest of it, it may not, the spark may not come and probably won't this summer, but I don't, I honestly don't think we are done with that what we saw last fall and winter in Oakland and New York and elsewhere was it.
It should be noted that the present day in your book is not actually the present day. It's 2013.
It will be one day.
It will someday be the present day, but it's not this one. It's 2013, so that begs the question, who won the election?
I know.
We're dying to know.
I know. I can't tell. I've been sworn to secrecy on that. No, I neglected to make that clear.
Now, certain... You did.
Yes.
I was looking for it.
Sorry.
There, like you said, there was a Hillary Clinton cameo, which was an oblique kind of just... she was mentioned.
She was a Goldwater canvasser in 1964 as a 17-year-old.
Who was heckled by the narrator
and her friend.
In a funny way. Let's just pretend if, say, Obama had snuck into your book, who would he have been? Where would he have shown up, and what role would he have played? Same question for Mitt Romney.
That's an interesting... an Obama figure. If I had spent more time, as I once did when this book was much longer, about dealing with my character's life as a lawyer for the Legal Aid Society and for instance, the young attorney Barack Obama could conceivably have figured in that. Or maybe he could have been a law student. Oh, no. He went to Harvard. Anyway, whatever. He could have been a law student of Karen's because she taught law even while she was a partner in a law firm. Mitt Romney, somebody asked me that question, and so I have something of an answer, which is that he's so, in the context of the 1960s, he's so absurd. He is so... such a caricature. I mean, if you had this guy who was just on whom the late 60s left no marks. The guy was 18 in 1967, or maybe 1965. Maybe he was born in 47. Yes, I think he was born in 47. Still young. And I think to have a Mitt Romney character in this novel, it just would have been a stock comic character. I mean. If to have a guy like that among them when they were 18. I mean, as you say, Hillary Clinton comes the closest as the Goldwater girl, ironically, to what Mitt Romney would be. But I think Mitt Romney is too implausible for fiction.
I'm going to segue into a question from the audience. How much of the 1960s New York City scene portrayed in the book is anecdotal? Did you glean some personal?
Well, most of the 1960s, the 1960s parts of the novel are set primarily in Chicago and the Chicago suburbs and Cambridge, Massachusetts. That's where Karen and her friends were for most of that time. It's a little bit in Washington and New York and here and there, but so. The suburban Chicago, I did some research, but it was mostly a kind of extrapolation of my own young life and observing my older siblings in Omaha. The New York life is really, she refers to it in the past. She now lives in Los Angeles. She's the dean of the UCLA Law School. Anecdotal, I mean, much of the stuff in the 60s, is either things, but a significant fraction are things I saw, imagined, experienced, twisted, deformed, used little bits of to grow into things for the purposes of the fiction. But there, and depending on what that question means, there are some specific historical things. There is... She visits New York as the musical Hair is opening in 1967, and doesn't want to go see it. And so there are specific historic anecdotal things mixed in with what is otherwise entirely made up.
And let's talk a little bit about your career, since it's been as sort of varied as your characters itself, herselves.
More, I would argue.
Probably more, yeah. So you you started off as a journalist, and an editor. And
I started off as a magazine writer, became an magazine editor for 10 years, and then started doing this.
And you started Spy Magazine with Graydon Carter, who's now the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. And this idea, one of the ideas, as you said, in the index of your book, the idea about James Bond sort of being a seminal influence for a lot of people, a lot of the kids of coming of age in the late 60s, that came from a Spy Magazine conversation. Can you recount that?
Yeah, back in 1989, we were having one of our editorial meeting conversations, and this idea that we are living in a Bond world with the Rupert Murdochs and the whoever was the Silvio Berlusconi of his day, that the world had become James Bond-like with all these super rich people living these outsized lives and North Korea being North Korea and all the rest. So that was a feature we did in Spy, and the fact that these children at 12 and 13 in 1961 and 62, in a way that I never was, are read every Ian Fleming James Bond novel and become obsessed the way I did a little later with things like Kurt Vonnegut and J.R.R. Tolkien, but they become obsessed with Bond at the height of the Cold War. And as my character Karen says, I mean, she grew out of it, but never quite. The James Bond template is always in her head when she goes to the new Beijing airport or drives a stick shift car on a European highway. She always hears the ding 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 in her head, basically. I acknowledge my Spy colleagues for that hour we spent talking about this idea 20 years ago, 23 years ago, and the piece that resulted. But so she, as she grows up, by the time she's 17, she thinks James Bond is ridiculous, and a tool, imperialist stooge, and all the rest. And as one should and would, graduates to John le Carré, and now writing this in the last decade, she says, actually, it is, I mean, the world is a lot James Bondier, maybe, or as James Bondy as it is Le Carré-esque. I mean, you know, psychopathic madmen in caves sending, suicide bombers halfway around the world and all the rest of it is a very James Bond potboiler.
There's a really funny paragraph that I want to read that goes into some of this. Rupert Murdoch and Silvio Berlusconi and Dick Cheney and Steve Ballmer and Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un are all Bond villains. Richard Branson and Tom Ford and Tom Cruise and Donald Trump and Julian Assange, such an Ian Fleming name, are Bond villains under the impression that they're actually Bonds. Valerie Plame Wilson and Carla Bruni Sarkozy and Madonna and Anna Wintour are, well, were in their 20s and 30s, Bond girls. All of these real people, are occurring to Karen and to you as the author as being totally realistic Bond characters, and is very convincing.
Yeah. Well, and one of the again, not that I began with this theme, but one of the things that came out of this, because the germ of this idea of these little kids being obsessed with Bond and going out and doing make-believe Bond missions in Evanston, was how people do, and I think kind of have more and more over the last 50 years, gotten invested in sort of fictions and fictionalized versions of themselves, it's the distinction, you know, with a freak like Donald Trump. I mean, he's a talk about implausible fictional characters. So that became one of the themes of the book is the power of fiction, whether it's movies you watch or television shows you watch or novels you read, and And there was a moment two-thirds of the way through when this plot that she gets involved with as a freshman in college has gone south. She says to herself, I am not a character in Flaubert. I am not a character in the Inflammable. I am not a fictional character, which was strange, of course, because here's this fictional character insisting to herself and the reader that she's not a fictional character. So I've never been a big metafictional guy, but I found myself doing it unavoidably. I think since 9/11, I think in this century, and not just in national security ways and foreign policy, but in the way the rich live large, that we live in a James Bond world more than we did when we were talking about it at Spy 20 years ago.
And you also, you write at one point that we current modern Americans self-fictionalize like crazy. We have avatars. We have sort of our social media projection, and then we have our real selves. Is this sort of the mania, this insanity of today that's the analog to the mania that Karen was dealing with in 1968?
That's an interesting question. It could be, and it could be indeed, you could make the argument, I suppose. I don't, but one could make the argument that it sucks the mania away into harmless paths in a way that wasn't quite done in the late 60s. Insanity is your word. I don't call those things insane. Exactly.
Didn't Karen feel the things she did?
Yeah,
you're
right.
Saying the things
no,
now.
No, totally.
Aren't
in retrospect, she thought
true.
she was.
Well, it's more of not insanity, but it is. It's sort of an addiction.
Yes,
certainly. It's
it
a
is.
Common
and a sense
moment.
Of sort of a stylized sense of your own destiny, and the world has become such that you have no choice but to sort of do what you're scripted to do. Well, and there's a, as you know, there's a scene when her granddaughter and her friends are down in Miami protesting the G20 summit. Her boyfriend gets his thumb almost blown off because the police fire a stun grenade, and he sees it smoking on the street, and he says, I know I shouldn't have picked it up, but I've seen all these YouTube videos of protesters all over the world, up against these, Star Wars troopers, and I saw this thing, and I've seen that so many times, I just picked it up to throw it, because that's what you're supposed to do in those scenes. So I do think there's an interesting ways in which especially young people perform versions of how they think they're supposed to be.
One of the best characters in the book and the most sort of endearing is the granddaughter, Waverly, 18 years old, very idealistic and blinded by her feverish sort of, idealism. But on the flip side, the funny thing I found about her, and this is something that we would be familiar with here in San Francisco, is that she's starting up a little this web concern. It's nonprofit. Granted, it's going to help the world, but it's a totally viable startup that probably somebody should start, if not you.
Certainly not me. But no, I she does have this idea. She's grown up in New York City and is always, from the time she was a little child, has been fascinated by homeless people on the street. And so she has this idea at 16 of asking homeless people if they would like all of the stuff they carry around in shopping carts digitized. And then she would put it on a server and they could go into public libraries or wherever and have a password protected means of having all their stuff, whether it's crazy stuff or birth certificates or whatever it is. And her grandmother helps her get a grant from a foundation to fund this. Seems like a reasonable idea to me.
Perhaps Craig Newbark from Craigslist, who's here in the audience, should start that up. Just an idea. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Kurt Anderson, co-founder and host of PRI's Studio 360 and New York Times bestselling author, who is discussing his new book, True Believers. I'm John Steinberg, editor-in-chief of San Francisco Magazine. Back to another question from the audience, unrelated to your book, but who are you reading now for inspiration, entertainment, or other purposes? Who do you like?
What did I just read? I just read a novel that's about to come out by a friend of mine named Susanna Moore, who wrote In the Cut and The Whiteness of Bones and a lot of other wonderful novels. This book coming out called The Life of Objects. The Life of Objects. It's about a girl an Irish girl who finds herself working as a servant, essentially, for an aristocratic German family in 1938, and can't then get out of Germany. It's a fantastic novel. I recently, interestingly, given you think I'd have my fill of the 60s, I went back and read Joan Didion's Slouching Toward Bethlehem recently, because I hadn't read it in 35 years, and it's extraordinary. And it made me realize. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, Joan Didion, she's a great writer. But I realize reading that now that there may be no more influential nonfiction writer of the last 50 years than Joan Didion. And one measure of that is how undated her writing from 1968 seems and how familiar, how current in its combination of precision and irony. It is, you know, what one as a magazine editor regards as good writing today. So it made me think, you know, that pretty much everyone or some large fraction of nonfiction writers since are Joan Didion wannabes. What else have I read? I just read The Age of Miracles because I interviewed the author, and that was a really interesting book. It's this bestseller about the Earth's rotation slows down. And it was interesting. It's a lovely book, but it was interesting two reasons. The idea of this sort of slow motion apocalypse. I mean, I've written for a few years for New York Magazine when you were there, about the sort of apocalyptomania of the last few years that shows itself in a lot of ways, and the fact that her vision of it in this novel is this. It's just the earth slowing down. It's no big. It's the world ending with a whimper rather than a bang. And this is ten. And basically, she's telling the story 10 years after it began. And you know, things are going screwy, but it's not gonna kill us all right away. And the other interesting thing about it is it's a YA book in a certain way, except for its apocalyptic theme. It's the story of an 11-year-old girl experiencing this. So that's very interesting to me. I don't know about inspired. The Joan Didion definitely. That inspired and stunned me to go back and read that book.
That's a great range from Joan Didion to a young adult novel. You run the gamut.
Yeah, but only women. I only read females.
No. Interestingly, can we talk about your writing process? I mean, you have pretty much a day job as the host of Studio 360.
Not quite. It's a weekly show. It's a 1 hour a week. If I had a daily show, I don't know what I'd do. But it's 1 hour a week. So it didn't start until I published my first novel and was devoted to writing books as the main thing I do. So I was able to sort of construct it around my life as a writer. And I write in the mornings, you know, until through lunch, and then
you go out with Charlie Rose at night.
Yeah, and then in the afternoons I do this radio show or write pieces for magazines when I do that. Basically it's a pretty simple thing. Right in the morning every day I can manage, and then do other stuff in the afternoon.
But the novel novelist period of your career has been through the last 15 years.
Yeah.
Is it more satisfying than previous incarnations?
Well, I mean, I'm always happy. I mean, I'm happy about what I'm doing when I'm doing it. And I've had the opportunity, luxury, vicissitude, forced by vicissitudes to do a bunch of different things, serially. So my life right now is my professional life is great and perfect. Is it when I feel as though I've written a good novel, I am as gratified by that feeling and by touching readers and having readers tell me that I've touched them than anything I've ever done. Also, because I've only been doing it for 15 years, I mean, I wrote, like many people, wrote a bad third of a novel when I was 23, but doesn't count. I'd written short fiction in between, but novels, 15 years. I've only been doing it 15 years, so I feel like I'm still new-ish at it. You know, I've been writing nonfiction and journalism for 35 years, and not that I, you know, that does, you know, that's it's writing is hard, but I'm more able to surprise myself and feel challenged, feel that sweet spot of can I do this? I think I can do it. Can I do this? That fiction still provides that in a way that journalism doesn't quite.
It does seem, when you're reading your books, that you're having a lot of fun. You're making up a lot of, there's a lot of fabulation in it, where you're inventing sort of counter histories. And for instance, in this book, you've created, in the present day, 2013, it's just closer to us than we think, you've created something called the Paul Plan, which is a proposal by Rand Paul and Ron Paul to create a Israel in the American West. Basically force?
Offer an invitation. Offer automatic citizenship.
Right, automatic invitation to any Israeli who wants to come live in Nevada. They get an American citizenship.
Let me be fair to the Paul's plan. That doesn't exist, which is they would create a commonwealth like Puerto Rico, but it would be created out of all this federal land, you know, between Utah and Nevada and eastern Oregon, anywhere, you know, wherever it made sense. For a period of time, any Israeli citizen could emigrate to the U.S. and, you know, have instant U.S. citizenship. And they could live there and create their own Israel simulacrum. They could live wherever they want. You and I could live there. I mean, it's a,
why would any right-minded Israeli want to do that?
Well, they may not. Well, a certain number of them. I mean, instant U.S. citizenship, and you know, I'm tired of living with this existential crisis all the time. But as the Pauls, I mean, because it's Rand Paul and Ron Paul, what their end game is after we give this magnanimous offer, we can, you know, wash our hands of Israel. And the ones who are staying, that's their problem. And they don't say that in proposing this plan, but that is their end game. I had a very interesting conversation with the writer Jeffrey Goldberg, who writes a lot about Israel for The Atlantic and his blog about this. And he was disturbed. I mean, he likes the book very much. He was disturbed that by putting this idea even into the stream, that some equivalent person could take it and try to make it real.
It must be pretty tempting to create a lot of the fantasies like that, where you're sort of liberally sprinkling them in throughout a book like this.
Yeah.
But isn't it tempting to write science fiction? Political science fiction,
well,
let's say?
A little. And actually, one of the things I'm thinking about is an actual work of science fiction is my next book. But for instance, I mean, and one of the reasons, because I like to do this in contemporary fiction, is to create these things like that, or like this drug that she sees advertised that is a serotonin uptake inhibitor that is marketed as a thing that enables religious and spiritual feeling if you take it. And more than one person has said to me, said, is that real? Or is that? And I gave it a Visontin. I gave it this drug-like name. And so one of the reasons it's fun to set it as it's out now, I mean, it won't be in the near future when people read it in a year or 5 years or whatever, but now is that thing of, and it's still true even when people read it after the date it is, of pushing it just to the edge of plausibility and mixing these things in with the real, and leaving people, I hope, happily confused about what's real and what's not.
There's one of my favorites also is a drone, a Hellfire drone used by the military that can fly at 40,000 feet and hit its mark like to the nail. But the key to it is that it's green. It's hydrogen powered, so it should appeal to all of the lefty environmentalists as well.
But now that is real. That is real.
Okay.
Or that's in development. That I got out of an aviation magazine. So, you can't make it up.
Would you like to read?
Sure.
A passage?
Sure.
We meant to do that earlier,
but we got
carried away.
I will read. This is six minutes seems perhaps the right amount of time to read. This is Karen has been persuaded by her granddaughter, Waverly, to join she and her friends on this trip to Miami to protest because her parents won't let her go unless somebody chaperones them. So she is sort of, just as Waverly's mother took her down to the Occupy Wall Street protest for 6 weekends running, and as Karen says, oh, so you're, instead of a hockey mom, you're a protest mom. Mm-hmm. So Waverly Karen has agreed to take the bus with them from New York, where she's visiting her daughter and Waverly, and go to Miami with them. She's staying in a nice hotel in South Beach, and the kids are staying at a hostel in Miami. And the protests begin. Karen is in her hotel room. Having lived in Los Angeles for 7 years, I am almost accustomed to the sound of helicopters hovering a few hundred feet overhead for minutes or hours at a time. But that peculiarly modern noise, always serious, usually sinister, has been vibrating my hotel room window since late this morning. Now that the chopper's fat grime beats have been joined by an unending wail of emergency vehicle sirens, I can't stay in bed reading and picking at the remains of my room service lunch. So I go out on my little balcony, tiptoe at the edge to look west and south toward the convention center and the anti-protester barricades. I see two black smoke plumes. Oh, Christ. During the last decade, I've grown unaccustomed to worrying about teenagers under my care. I turn on the TV to watch the live coverage. It's on 3 national and 4 local channels. Bank windows have been smashed. U.S. mailboxes filled with gasoline and set on fire. Tear gas fired. Microwave stun weapons deployed. 200 protesters arrested. More than 24 injured. One breaking both legs when the 15-foot-tall Uncle Sam puppet he was operating collapsed on him. Another when a driver under the influence pulled a pistol and fired a shot at a group of protesters in white makeup and ripped up American flags splattered with fake blood, pretending to be zombies who had surrounded his Mercedes. I mute the TV. The orchestra of helicopters and sirens is as loud as ever. I call Waverly's cell phone again. She doesn't answer. I text her. Still no reply. Should I go outside and try to find her among the 10,000 kids playing revolution all over Miami Beach? In order to, what, make myself feel better because I would be pointlessly acting instead of pointlessly fretting? And if by some impossible chance I do spot her, then what? Cross the police line and threaten to spank her if she doesn't come home with me right this second? I smell tear gas. Jesus, I feel responsible. I enabled this. The zombie girl shot by the drunk Mercedes driver is in critical condition. 3.5 hours pass, and I have no word from Waverly. I pray she's all right. She's here in my room, in bed, I say to Greta, my daughter, Waverly's mom. I do not say, using my laptop and enjoying the free Wi-Fi and the 400 thread count Egyptian cotton sheets, spending the night at the most luxurious anarchist safe house in history. She's sort of conked out, although not asleep. She's mouthing, thank you. Yes, she threw up, I say into the phone, and she's got a bit of a rash or something on her neck, and her eyes are watering, but she's perfectly fine. Tell him there is no permanent record to worry about since she wasn't arrested. She's so fine that she's shaking her head and rolling her bloodshot eyes. Yes, room service, a big bowl of vichyssoise and a cheese plate and a piece of carrot cake. I don't know what RADS is. And has this pediatrician ever encountered a case of reactive airways disease syndrome caused by exposure to tear gas? This was tear gas, Greta, not the dust and smoke from the World Trade Towers collapsing. No, I'm sorry. It's been a very intense day. I know you're concerned, but I know. No, Waverly didn't get pepper sprayed, only Sophie. The emergency room doctor was mistaken. My friend's surgeon said Hunter will definitely keep his thumb. No, a stun grenade, not a hand grenade. And the police didn't attack him because Sophie didn't tell me she was planning to use the hotel's bike to commit a level 7 felony. That's why. And I'll pay for the bike. But honestly, you're acting like I was the mastermind or something. What do you mean Sophie's mother is counting on me? Honey, I am not going to call Janet Reno. And besides, I don't think she's got any pull in Dade County these days. The finest possible legal representation, I appreciate that, Sophie's mother, as I'll tell her when she gets here. But A, I haven't been in a courtroom since 2004. B, I haven't done a criminal defense since you were in first grade. C, I'm not admitted to practice in Florida. And D, this is not the fucking Chicago 7, honey. I will be very surprised if the U.S. attorney doesn't file a motion to dismiss the federal charges against Sophie. Now, what the elected state attorney from Miami-Dade County might decide to do to a New York kid with a multicolored couple of swear words tattooed above her left breast, however, I can't pretend to predict. Under Florida law, I learned this afternoon, possessing a hoax weapon of mass destruction is a level 7 felony, which, even with no injuries and no priors, could mean a 2-year minimum sentence. Okay, I love you too, Greta. Waverly obeyed the police order to leave Dade Boulevard, and she swears she didn't even see the looted public supermarket or the FedEx truck that was set on fire. Hunter admits that he was stupid to pick up the unexploded stun grenade, but he told his father and me in the recovery room that he'd watched so many YouTube videos of so many young protesters around the world picking up smoky canisters off pavements and throwing them back at cops dressed like Star Wars stormtroopers that it was kind of an automatic response, the stage direction he was supposed to follow in that scene. And Sophie did not think of herself as transporting a hoax weapon of mass destruction. She had no idea that after she took a wrong turn on the Raleigh Hotel bike I lent her and stopped to ask for directions that she was near a 9/11 memorial. In Sophie's mind, she was heading for her star turn on the protesters' stage at Flamingo Park, where she was going to perform her multimedia performance art piece called Eve of Destruction. That's why Sophie was wearing a flesh-colored cat suit with 200 real dollar bills safety pinned all over it, and why she had a rubber snake, an apple, some kind of electronic hourglass, 200 black gumballs, and 20 red sticks of realistic-looking fake dynamite in her backpack. All day I've been thinking of my favorite line from Karl Marx about how historical events happen twice, the first time is tragedy and the second time is farce. Now the thought occurs to me that when we were young, playing secret agents with licenses to kill and then playing anti-war radicals, exactly the reverse happened. I sort of feel guilty, my granddaughter tells me as I hand her two more Advils, that Hunter got hurt and Sophie got busted and nothing really happened to me, you know? Thanks.
It's terrific dynamic between Waverly and her grandmother. And this is not a grandmother that I'm familiar with, by the way.
You're lost.
She is the coolest, and it's been noted, hottest grandma on the block. She gets she's actually kind of a sexy grandma. She is alluring and magnetizing to men and has trysts.
I think you're imagining this, John. I didn't say any of that. This is your view. But no, she's a fully, you know, she's 63 years old, but, you know, hasn't decided life's over.
She kind of seems like your superwoman, having it all. We're stepping into that debate, I suppose. But
well, she hasn't had it all, and she regrets that she didn't spend time with her daughter growing up, and certainly she regrets this secret lie she's lived with all her life and all of its consequences. So, but, yeah, she's had a good career, and since she left her husband 7 years earlier, has had a good rest of her life, too.
I'm going to go to another...
But I find it weird, frankly, that you're not the first person who said, whoa, this 63-year-old grandmother still sleeping with men. Like, really? I mean...
More power to her.
Yeah.
She's... I have to say, she's frisky.
Mm.
She comes across like she's... her and Waverly competing for who gets more, you know, action... Grandma wins.
Well.
Interestingly.
Huh. I guess.
I'm just asking what subconsciously
you're imagining a whole extracurricular life on Karen's part that I didn't write, but I'm happy to hear it. I think part of that is that people who were born in 1949 or 1956 or whatever, for better and for worse, never were required to say at age 25, the way my parents were, I'm an adult now, and at 50 or 60, I'm old now. There is a version of forever young that is true.
I wanted to bring up a column that you wrote. It was last year. This is somewhat of a change of subject, but it was about Barack Obama. Since we're heading back into another election season, I thought it might be interesting to talk about. And that in some ways you felt it was a pity that he wasn't more like Richard Nixon. And you had very good reasons for saying that. That he lacked sort of a ruthlessness and tough-mindedness that Nixon displayed, but also because Nixon governed further to the left, you stated, than any president after him.
Correct.
I'm sure you took a lot of heat for that.
Not as much as I have for other things I've written, but it certainly is. It is a version of Richard Nixon that is, huh? What? Mm-hmm. But yes, he's the guy who created OSHA and created EPA and presided over the huge expansion of the National Endowments for Arts and Humanities, and I could go on and on. Also, I mean, talk about socialism. He enacted wage and price controls in 1971. And, Richard Nixon, I mean, of course, he is the son of a bitch that we know from history, but, and it perhaps is much, it's probably as much a function of the times, i.e., being president from 1969 to 1974, as his deep liberal convictions, but to govern effectively when Richard Nixon was president, a conservative Republican had to be slightly to the left of the middle of modern Democrats. That's right.
It must have been a difficult thing to come to grips with, though, for a New York sort of situated.
When I have an idea that I really believe and is somewhat counterintuitive, I come to grips with it very easily.
As we move into this whole election season, there is a certain sense that I have that of perhaps it's just fatigue after a pretty rough 4 years, but that it's not as, we're not as interesting as we used to be in 1968 and afterwards, and maybe it's these two candidates. There's something not quite as enthralling about this cycle as in past ones. Do you share?
Sure. I mean, I was a big Obama supporter, and I am still an Obama supporter, but the moment he was elected, My regard changed. It was really interesting. I have not been as excited, like so many people, as excited about a presidential candidate in years and years and years and years, maybe ever, as I was about Obama in 2008. But as soon, like November 8th, as soon as those emails kept coming in, and especially after he was actually president, and those Obama campaign emails, I kind of wanted nothing to do with them at a certain point. And not because he disappointed me, and he hasn't really particularly disappointed me, but just, okay, you're the president now. I could be excited about somebody who was trying to be president and who probably never would become president, but I find myself not as able to be excited about somebody who is president. And maybe that's me, or maybe that's the nature of today. I know what you mean. I do think that the debates between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are going to be great.
Why is that?
Oh, because I think they're both intelligent people. I think we will really, well, from my personal, you know, ideological perspective, I think seeing Mitt Romney not able to just pivot to the right and pander to the you know, crazy tail wagging his party's dog, and having the president who is hold him accountable. I'm really looking forward to those debates more than the debates themselves. I'm really interested in
a show of hands who agree. Okay. Well, it's interesting that you take away the right-wing pandering from Romney, and they become a lot more similar than you would think.
I tweeted that very thing the other day. that basically, Mitt Romney circa 2005 is pretty much Barack Obama circa 2012. I mean, there's some differences, but, like, no stark choice. He was, and perhaps is this moderate technocrat, and the differences are not very stark. Well, I mean, that's the amazing thing to me about this moment is what the Republican Party, what I grew up in a Republican household. I knew reasonable, socially liberal Republicans. They were my parents and my uncles and everybody I knew growing up. Before she died, my Nebraska mother left the Republican Party at age 73, saying, "This is crazy town."
When was that?
In the early part of this, you know, like 1999, 98. And again, it's Nebraska. I mean, you know, she was a Goldwater Republican. So, so that's to me part of me, again, writing about the 1960s and thinking about the 1960s, so much of this, of the radicalism on the right, is as though, people who didn't get their yah-yahs out as new leftists 40 years ago are now getting their yah-yahs out as new rightists. It's as uncompromising and nihilistic as some of the stuff at the extremes got then. It just amazes me. And that tail is wagging that dog to a degree. I would argue that the equivalent tail never wagged the dog of the Democratic Party.
And here's the irony about that nihilism. And this is our last question. We've reached the end of the program. Is that their nihilism and extremism really mirrors it's the polar opposite of Karen's in your book. She is the sort of far left fringe of that same sentiment.
That's true, and she understood as soon as she peeked into the abyss and by the luck of the draw didn't fall, that this was crazy, and immediately scurries back and realizes how crazy the crazy place she'd gotten herself into. It's a funny mirror, and it reminds me of one of my top three favorite quotes of all time, which is usually attributed to Mark Twain, but he perhaps didn't say it. Nevertheless, it sounds very Mark Twainish, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And the kind of powerful, manic, no compromise extremism on the right is a 50 or 40 years, 45 years later mirror, I think, as you've suggested.
Our thanks to Kurt Anderson, co-founder and host of PRI's Studio 360 and New York Times best-selling author. We also thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the internet. I'm John Steinberg, the editor-in-chief of San Francisco Magazine, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.